Father in heaven, we meet again today. We again are asking for your presence. You would provide your wisdom and your trueness to whatever information is presented here today. We ask for your presence, your sweet spirit to be in this class. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Yeah, I sort of wish I could shut this door, but I'm told I should not shut this door for security reasons, I guess. Something like that, yeah. Good morning. All right, here's a quiz. This is pass or fail, by the way. This is pass or fail quiz. Ready? How many of you read the New York Times article, All Rock, No Action? All right, about almost half of you did. Okay. Hate to punish those who read it, but I'm just going to spend a teeny bit of time on this, okay? Because I know people are coming in. So anyway, he starts out making reference to Live 8, that extraordinary media event that some people of good intentions in the West just orchestrated. He said it would have left us Africans indifferent if we hadn't realized that it was an insult, both to us and to common sense. He says, we have nothing against those who this month in a stadium, a street, a park in Berlin, London, Moscow, Philadelphia, gathered crowds and played guitar and talked about global poverty and aid for Africa. But we are troubled to think that they are so misguided about what Africa's real problem is and dismayed by their willingness to propose solutions on our behalf. We Africans know what the problem is, and no one else should speak in our name. Africa has men of letters and science, great thinkers and stifled geniuses who, at the risk of torture, rise up to declare the truth and demand liberty. So you take that paragraph there, and this is sort of a situation. This is a part of the history of aid. I'm not wanting to make a judgment here. I'm simply saying that, for example, the World Bank in their charter, written into their charter is the idea that we will ignore the government of whatever country we're in. Okay. Well, you can see where they would have good motives for doing that. You know, they're there to feed the poor. Unfortunately, oftentimes, I'll just say too many times, it has had the effect of propping up dictators. Okay. So it's kind of beyond us. It's kind of complicated. They're sure that I'm going to be able to do much about that problem, but it's a part of what we're talking about. And this is what this man is talking about. He says, don't insult Africa, this continent so rich yet so badly led. Instead, insult its leaders who have ruined everything. Our anger is all the greater because despite all the presidents for life, despite all the evidence of genocide, we didn't hear anyone at Live 8 raise a cry for democracy in Africa. Don't the organizers of the concerts realize that Africa lives under the oppression of rulers? And he mentions the name here, who just eliminated term limits in Uganda so he can be president indefinitely, and Omar Bongo, who has become immensely rich in his 3 decades of running Gabon. Don't they know what is happening in Cameroon, Chad, Togo, and the Central African Republic? Don't they understand that fighting poverty is fruitless if dictatorships remain in place? And he says that some more, neither debt relief nor huge amounts of food aid nor an invasion of experts will change anything. These will merely prop up the continent's dictators. It's up to each nation to liberate itself and to help itself. When there is a problem in the United States, in Britain, and France, the citizens vote to change their leaders. In those times when it wasn't possible to freely vote to change those leaders, the people revolted. In Africa, our leaders have led us into misery, and we need to rid ourselves of these cancers. We would have preferred for the musicians in Philadelphia and London to have marched and sung for political revolution. Instead, they mourned a corpse while forgetting to denounce the murderer. What is at issue is in Africa, where dictators kill, steal, and usurp power, yet are treated like heroes at meetings of the African Union. What is at issue is rulers like François Bozize, I'm sure I pronounced that wrong, the coup leader running the Central African Republic, mentions another name here, who just succeeded his father as president of Togo, free to trample universal suffrage and muzzle their people with no danger that they'll lose their seats at the United Nations. Who here wants a concert against poverty when an African is born, lives, and dies without ever being able to vote freely? But the truth is that it was not for us, for Africa, that the musicians at Live 8 were singing. It was to amuse the crowds and to clear their own consciences, and whether they realized it or not, to reinforce dictatorships. They still believe us to be like children that they must save, as if we don't realize ourselves what the source of the problem is. So that's a cry from an intellectual leader in Africa. So it's complicated. But that whole thing illustrates, as I said yesterday, paternalism, and it also illustrates, it's just throwing money at the problem without really understanding the problem. So that's a principle that is taking place for, you know, whole nations, but it's also in our own dealing with individuals. We're just throwing money at a problem that we don't really, haven't taken the time to understand. You get me? Okay, so we're going to finish up talking about aid for just a little bit here, and then we're going to move on to something more positive. But I have just a little bit more video to show. Let's see what we got here. I don't want to say anything. Okay, so 8 minutes. The first 8 minutes is just a clear example how aid can hurt in the long term. Yes? Handouts are on the way, but because I didn't finish yesterday, I think I'm skipping my Bible portion today. Pretty much what's in the handout is my Bible portion. So we'll be good on that. I'll just do that tomorrow. So, yeah. After that, I have a short thing about NGOs. And then another talk by an African economist, professor, intellectual leader, very short. And then we'll be about done with that, okay?
Making small experience with the solar panels.
This raw material, we want them to become actual streetlights, solar streetlights.
We want them to be part of something special. And because both of us, we grew up in Haiti, so we know what the situation is.
You have plenty of sunshine.
So is there a way that you can harvest energy from the sun and to resolve the energy problem? So this is something that is it's completely different. And it
wait a minute.
Completely new.
Sorry about that. So these are some friends from Haiti that started a solar lighting business from scratch. Ended up being able to hire a number of fathers from shanty towns, change their lives, and we see what happened.
At the beginning, almost everybody thought those guys were really crazy. They don't have nothing to do, spending their time making some experiment on solar panels and getting light bulbs. And even now, we come with the product and say, this is Haitian-made product. Most of people, they don't believe us.
At the beginning, having a $500 contract was great news, because we have money for next week.
This is the way we started. Now, we are like 62 employees right now. So we think we found the right track. Most of the employees we have come from Gentilla, some from Cité Soleil, some from Matissan, Cité Castro, you know, very populated area. We train them here. There is no social security network in Guinea. So for our workers, we are the social security network. If they were not working, probably some of them would be gang members. In fact, when we were studying in Israel, the situation was really, really bad in Haiti. And some of the guys, they are trying to recruit them to become gang members. I mean, they offer you like $500 and a gun, and you are an unemployed guy, you have no future in this way, you don't see yourself as part of nothing. So it's easy to accept this offer. And the temptation is high. And some of the guys at the beginning, I mean, we were really smart, and they were calling me and saying, "Gee, I have no money, I have nothing." I say, "Don't go there, don't go there. Because you have no future in the game." We have installed 200 lights in Cité Soleil. They know that Enosa is hiring people from Cité Soleil and what to like to Cité Soleil. When you do something, you can see the impact on the population. And you can say, "This is because of me." Those NGOs, they're changing the mentality of the people. Now we have a generation with a dependence mentality. When it becomes an industry of its own, the industry of charity, it creates more harm than good to the country. But there are different ways that can help.
We have an experience with Partners Worldwide. We are working in Haiti, and this is an NGO that supports businesses. So they help you set up your business. They give you training, they try to put you on their network, they try to sell your goods. They do everything that can help your business grow. Some NGOs also are training technicians, construction workers, mechanic guys, electricians, and they are giving them possibility to start their own business. They are teaching them how to fish, not to give them the fish every day. Your goal should be to give me fishing work and to teach me how to fish and then move out. But after 40 years, if you're still here, there's a problem.
Okay, so I just want to say that they mentioned the one NGO, their Partners Worldwide, who are doing things quite a bit differently. I think they're in, I won't say, but many, many countries. They are a group of, frankly, reformed businessmen. I mean, when I say reformed, I mean, they call it, reformed, their church, what do you call them?
Christian
Reformed, yes. And I was so, like I said, I've done a lot of reading and so on and so forth. And before I saw them on this video, I actually discovered this Partners Worldwide, and I was thrilled because I could see they were doing things totally differently. And then to find out they were right in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And they're in many, many countries around the world. Businessmen who are going to these countries as advisors, coming alongside, helping. It's really, really a tremendous thing that they're doing. And I actually will talk about them a little bit tomorrow. I just wanted to skip a little section here. It's hard to get exact, so I'm just going to start here. We'll see about 10 seconds or so of I don't know what.
Understanding is in the context of the Cold War, competing for the resources, and a neo-type of colonialism.
You know, Tucker Hayes is saying, you know, we had colonialism, we had neo-colonialism, we had neo-colonialism, now we haven't developed more. Which is just another colonialism.
I once spent a rather happy afternoon in a place called Malabar, counting the number of vehicles with different aid agencies.
Theodore Dalrymple is an English physician who has worked in Tanzania, Zimbabwe, South Africa, and the Gilbert Islands. He returned to the United Kingdom in 1990, where he served as a psychiatrist with prisoners and in inner-city Birmingham. He is the author of numerous books, including Zanzibar to Timbuktu and Life at the Bottom.
Malabo is the capital of Equatorial Guinea, where the first democratically elected president killed or drove into exile approximately a third of the population, and he used to keep the national treasury under his bed. When the president left the capital, they turned the electricity off as being no longer required. So I counted the number of aid agencies, and I think I counted in about 3 hours, I counted 27 in large white Toyotas, air conditioner. And really, the devastation of Equatorial Guinea was very good business for them. The salary is very good. It tends to be tax-free. Unlike your life at home, you will have servants. And I think it was Schumpeter who said that one servant is worth a household full of appliances.
A lot of the donor agencies, when I see the country heads driving around in the posh cars and living in the big houses, I see multiple colonial governments. This is the new phase of the colonial government.
Ghanaian software entrepreneur Herman Chinnery-Hesseng is the founder of SoftTribe and BSL.
Let's just skip that part there. See if I can figure out how to forward this just a little bit. Excuse me. I want to go to, I'll just go there.
We are no longer getting excited by
thank you.
Aid
thank you
from
much.
IMF, from the World Bank. They must exploit your misery by giving you a loan, make you a slave, economic slave, because you are chained by the loan. So it becomes a way of colonizing the economies of the poor countries.
Now, there are a lot of Africans who are very angry. Angry. At the condition of Africa. The cheetah generation is the new breed of Africans. They are going to wait for governments to do things for them. That's the cheetah generation. And Africa's salvation rests on the backs of these cheetahs. In contrast, of course, we have the hippo generation.
The hippo generation are the ruling elites. They are those who have monopolized political power. And they are those who are stuck in their muddy pedagogical patch. And they believe that the only way you can solve the problems in Africa is by giving the state more power and more foreign aid. And it is on the back of this people generation which the United Nations, the World Bank, and the IMF have been trying to hitch a ride with this same old aid-driven boondog. And that's why we're not getting anywhere in Africa. Out of the 54 African countries, only 16 of them are democratic. Now, these leaders stay in office 10, 20, 30, and even 40 years in office. And they don't even step down. They groom their sons to take over. Africans are fed up with this kind of leadership.
When people support more foreign aid for Africa, the more they're condemning us in Africa to live under dictators who will not respect our rights to access to rule of law.
No doubt originally the idea was compassionate. You saw people suffering from poverty, and therefore your immediate response is to give. But unfortunately, giving on a large scale distorts. Take a country like Tanzania, where I actually work. Its greatest receipt in foreign currency was from aid. And the whole of the political process actually was who got their hand on the aid.
Make no mistake, I am not against humanitarian aid. Of course, if something, a disaster happens, we better rally and help each other. But when humanitarian aid becomes a way of life, then we all have a big problem. Emergency disaster relief has become the permanent model. And that model is what I call the current aid industry.
I have never heard of a country that developed on aid. If you know of one, just let me know. I know about countries that developed on trade and innovation and business. I don't know of any country that got so much aid and they suddenly became a first world country. I've never heard of such a country. So the track is wrong. That track ends to nowhere.
There is a school of thought out there that I don't agree with, where indeed people think they owe the poor people to give them money without thinking about how they are going to use this money. Aid leads to more aid and more aid and more aid and less independence of the people that are receiving aid. Second is the wrong notion. For people who have money or who give aid, they feel good that they're helping. But the best way to help is to help people to be able to stand on their own.
Our government are not encouraged to buy local. Now, when we talk to the international donor community, they say it's not their policy and that we are in Kalkukuland. When we talk to the government says, hey, we're not allowed to buy with donor money local products. That's just the way it is. It's their money, they decide who gets it. For example, five companies in Ghana got together to bid for a contract.
Together? No. Everything was going very well.
Okay. So just another little skip here. I think we already saw that portion there. So I'm just going to jump ahead just a teeny bit. I want you to see pretty interesting about 1 minute here. So right after this guy. It's not available on YouTube yet. You got to buy it.
A large part of aid is, of course, a subsidy to the companies that do the work in African countries. I myself worked on such a project, and I saw myself the incredible waste. It was a road project, actually, in Tanzania. And the foreign aid amounted to a huge subsidy for a company that could not possibly have got the contract in a real market. And these can amount to hundreds of millions of dollars. And the so-called foreign aid actually goes back to the people working for the company, and I suppose the shareholders of that company. And I myself am personally a beneficiary. Anyway, I bought my first house from the proceeds of foreign aid. Foreign aid has been excellent to me. It's aided me immensely. It's allowed me to have an interesting life, to travel, live in good condition, be well paid, no tax. Couldn't do that.
Everybody in development
agrees. Everybody knows the system doesn't work. They don't say it's public.
You sit down and have beers with somebody, you sit down, you know, we all feel the same thing. The system's broken, it's not working, it's not happening like it's supposed to be. Everybody's, some people get very emotional about it. Everybody in development knows this is something wrong.
I believe, you know. I'm not saying anything that anybody else doesn't know.
All right, so that is our video. The rest of our section about aid, okay? And, well, actually, I wanted to show you just one more because I want you to just be aware. You mentioned that. Let's see here. You mentioned YouTube. Let's see here. These particular videos are not. Actually, they do have short flicks of them on YouTube. You can find that under on YouTube under the channel called Acton Institute. Acton, A-C-T-O-N, as in Lord Acton. I just wanted to show you very short of another important player. This is off of YouTube, so it's this is another African, a woman that came out of Zambia, who got her master's at Harvard, her PhD at Oxford. She's an economist. She worked for the big Western financial companies, and she wrote a book called Dead Aid. She's very passionate, highly intelligent. I'm just going to have her for about a minute and a half here because she is an important, I guess you could say, player in this, important opinion influencer, okay?
Many of us believe that aid to Africa is crucial to lift people out of poverty.
Not yet, to use that point. The controversy over what she argued that foreign aid has been a disaster for Africa and must stop.
Moya was born and raised in Zambia, but educated at Oxford and Harvard.
She's worked for both the World Bank and Goldman Sachs. Her book is called Dead Aid. In the West, it's been drummed into us that we have a moral responsibility to provide more aid to Africa. Now, in your new book, you start from the premise that not only is aid not a solution, it in fact is part of a problem. Explain that general thesis.
The problem is that it is malignant, and the book basically outlines many, many reasons why it is that aid has failed to deliver on its original promises. Let me just take a little bit back in history as to what the origins of the aid model are. The 1950s and 60s were a time when many African countries in particular, but emerging countries in general, were coming out of a colonial period. And at this time, there was a literature by an economics space by Christopher Chinnery and Strout in the 1966 paper, where they basically identified a very simple equation that savings leads to investment leads to growth. But the argument at that time was that in poor countries, there was no savings because these were newly formed countries that didn't have the requisite savings that could lead to investment and equity to growth. So basically, policymakers at the time said instead of savings, we'll use aid, and the aid would and aid would lead to investment and aid would lead to growth. And the idea was that we would get not only growth, but we'd have an alleviation of poverty, because with growth, you could then move people out of poverty. But if you look back over the past 60 years, where Africa's received over $1 trillion of aid, the issue then becomes, on those two metrics, growth and poverty, have things improved? And the answer is a resounding no.
It's not crashing, and you're pointing yourself backwards.
Absolutely.
It's the per capita income.
That's exactly right.
Just explain that to me.
Sure.
That seems perfect. $1 trillion gone, essentially.
Basically.
Yeah, and poverty more entrenched.
Absolutely. And just to illustrate, in the 1970s, about 10% of Africans lived on $1 a day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over 70% of Africans live on $1 a day. So things have got fundamentally worse. And if you look at growth, again, Africa, to quote Paul Collier, who's my PhD supervisor, Africa is actually shearing off. So things are getting worse, and the rest of the world is moving in one direction, Africa's going in a completely different direction.
Basically, you're saying, look, what we should be doing in the Western world is giving Africa countries notice. 5 years.
So, Dambisa Moyo, her book Dead Aid, it's been around a while. Eventually, I'm going to get around to handing out my bibliography list. It's not on there just because it has been around a while, but she's highly intelligent and, again, a passionate spokesperson for Africa, saying, please, don't help us anymore. Not the way you're doing it. Okay. Okay, so that is the end of the AIDS section. You feel bad enough now? Are you totally deflated? Yes.
I'm hoping, of course, I'm new to this session. Are you going to show us an example of a successful aid program?
Wow, let's do that.
And evangelism as well.
Okay. All right. Great minds think alike, huh? So, as soon as I give this, I don't know how long a talk on this one slide here, we're going to go into that, okay? So here is, you know what, because this is the only slide I'm going to use. The rest I'm going to save till tomorrow because I'm trying to fit things in. I'll just wait and I'm going to have them collated when you come in. So, okay, so teach a man to fish. This is, we already made reference to this in our class. Also, even in our video, I think somebody made reference to this well-known saying, you know, give them a fish, they eat for a day. Teach them to fish, they eat for a lifetime. What this phrase sort of misses and what we need to be aware of, what we need to think about is, I guess you could say, the actual lake that the fishing is being done in. Okay? I can teach a person to fish up in northern Ontario. It won't take much teaching. You know, they can put about anything on the end of the line, and before very long, they're going to pull out a great big fish, right? If I take them down to my hometown and take them to the Flint River, teach them how to fish, why, they're probably not going to have much success, right? And this is the thing we have to keep in mind, is that African people, Haitian people, they know how to fish. Number one, they have not been given access to the lake, that is to free markets. Number two, the lake that they are fishing in is so polluted, as in corruption and dictatorship and high taxes and loan sharks and whatever else is on the list, that even if they catch a little tiny fish, it's not even going to be good. You get the point? So, and this again is the macro picture, and you and I may not have much influence on that, at least as individuals. We'd like to think we would eventually as a group, but we have to be aware of the situation, and that is the situation. And that goes back to the paternalism. People in these countries are not poor because they're dumber than us. It's because they're born in a place where the lake is not much good for fishing. And this is extremely important. Now, I just want to give you an example here from Hernando de Soto's book, The Mystery of Capitalism. I'm going to show you some video from him in a moment. He is one of the people who has done more to help the poor in this world than, you know, he's one of the top five in my book. And I just want to share a few thoughts from his book before we go into that, introducing him on video. Here, he says, imagine a country where nobody can identify who owns what. Addresses cannot be easily verified. People cannot be made to pay their debts. Resources cannot conveniently be turned into money. Ownership cannot be divided into shares. Descriptions of assets are not standardized and cannot be easily compared. And the rules that govern property vary from neighborhood to neighborhood or even from street to street. You've just put yourself into the life of a developing country or former communist nation. More precisely, you have imagined life for 80% of its population, which is marked off as sharply from its westernized elite as black and white South Africans were once separated by apartheid. So he's saying that a lack of property rights and a lack of rule of law are huge when it comes to poverty. And here is a little story here. So by the way, this man, he's from Peru. He's an economist from Peru. And there was, I guess I'll just call them communists for lack of a more precise term, sort of communists slash terrorists who were running the show there. And he, as an economist, began to understand. He finally understood, and he wrote a book about private property, the right of private property, and how, you know, as one major reform, the other just simple rule of law. Well, his offices were bombed. His car was bombed. His offices were machine gunned, or one or the other. Either way, it's not a very pleasant experience. He had published a book, and that's when he started experiencing these things. And he told himself, he said he was walking. Anyway, he's about ready to pull out. He said, no. He said, you know, I don't know if this man's Roman Catholic. I really don't know. But he said, no, this is truth. The world is dying for, and I'm going forward. And by God's grace, he conquered. He's still alive. Had a huge influence in Peru. And now his services are asked for from many countries around the world. Simply trying to help these countries sort out these issues of private property and rule of law. Okay, and I just want to share this experience here. He went into in Peru, and they've done this. They've repeated this experiment in various countries. One of his lawyer friends told him that if he wanted to set up a business, they could do that in about 30 days. About 30 days. He himself, you know, a man of means and successful person and speaks English and so on. Well, he took two, I think they were graduate students. They bought, two sewing machines, something like this. And he said he wanted them to go out and set up and legalize this business. These two individuals, I'm going from memory here, I'm just going to read this. He says, our goal was to create a new and perfectly legal business. The team then began filling out the forms, standing in the lines, and making the bus trips into central Lima to get all the certifications required to operate according to the letter of the law, a small business in Peru. Notice, they spent 6 hours a day at it and finally registered the business 289 days later. Oh, wow. 6 hours a day. 289 days later, they were able to open a business with, as he says here, although the garment workshop was geared to operating with only one worker, the cost of legal registration was $1,231, 31 times the monthly minimum wage. He says to obtain legal authorization to build a house on state-owned land took 6 years and 11 months, requiring 207 administrative steps and 52 government offices. To obtain a legal title for that piece of land took 728 steps. We also found that a private bus, jitney, or taxi driver who wanted to obtain official recognition of his route faced 26 months of red tape. Okay. Also mentions here the Philippines. Person who has built a dwelling in a settlement on either state-owned or privately owned urban land, to purchase it legally, he would have to form an association with his neighbors in order to qualify for state housing finance program. The entire process could necessitate 168 steps involving 53 public and private agencies and taking 13 to 25 years.
Why? Why?
Well, it's called corruption. It's called corruption bureaucracy. So this is a part of the lake, you see what I'm saying? And I just want to tell this story. Here in the United States, there's a family that moved here. They're refugees. They happen to be Karen refugees. Probably you don't know about the Karen, but they suffered horribly in their Karen state, which is in the country of Burma. And genocide for decades. And we have a number of them in the Grand Rapids area. And this particular family arrived here about 6-7 months ago. They're Buddhists, 6 boys. They came directly from a refugee camp in Thailand, where all these boys would have been born. 3 of the boys belonged to this lady's sister who had died. In any case, we helped them to do their income taxes. He came here, started working right away in one of the rendering factories, and so he needed to do his taxes. So we helped him. Actually, I was able to get him an appointment at one of the places in town, legitimate places that does taxes for free for poor people. And they did their taxes very well. And then they got a letter from IRS, which of course they couldn't read the letter, but I was able to read the letter. I never saw such a letter in my life. I paid taxes about every 3 years ever since I've been. No. I never saw such a letter, and maybe, I guess it's new, but they're saying because of, identity theft, before we send you your refund check, which they had 6 kids, so it was quite a check, over $1,000 was a lot of money for these people, more money than they ever made in their whole lives, for sure. But anyway, we need you to go online and, we have some questions there so you can prove that you're you. So I took all their information. I went online. And, of course, I couldn't get the job done. The system said, I'm sorry, we can't. I put all the information in there. Sorry, we can't confirm who you are. You're going to have to call us. Well, I already knew that I'd have to go to their house and, make sure they're sitting there to give this guy permission. They would ask this lady or her husband, is it okay if we talk to him? So I went to their home, made this call. I'll say I got through quite quickly. But no, they don't do that. We don't do that over the phone. You're going to have to make an appointment. So that was, that was May or something. So today is the appointment. And fortunately, one of my friends is taking that family this afternoon to the IRS, loaded with, by the way, the guy told me, I said, they have their Homeland Security card. I would guess that wouldn't be easy to make a counterfeit. It's from the United States government. You get that when you come here as a refugee. And we don't accept, he said, that's not on my list. We don't accept that idea. So I'm just saying, here's this family. This is where, we can help. There's a lot of people in Michigan. They come here, they don't know the language, they certainly don't know the system. And if I hadn't have happened to hear about this family, And I, believe me, I've heard of several cases where tax preparers have taken really good money to do a really poor job on these people's taxes. And, you know, I would dare say, although I don't know, I would dare say they would never got their tax refund. And I hope today goes well. So, not to sound like a politician or a anti-politician, but government can very much get in the way. It certainly does in most of these countries, and to some extent, although thank God, not so much, but even in our country. Yes?
This is the way I think we're going to lose our freedom, is because mm-hmm. of things like this. On the other hand, my son and his wife, they had my daughter-in-law. Somebody did file for them. And they, so
really?
They, so these, yes. But right. It all worked out so that their transfer of the address and everything,
wow.
it got stopped. But it took a month and months and months to work out. So yeah. These things are put in place.
Yeah.
But it's going to destroy our liberties.
Right.
A place for protection. But.
Yep. Okay. So, teach a man to fish, yes. But be aware that many people do not have a lake to fish in. That's not much. Yes, sir.
Christian Reformed people, what program are they doing? Or?
It's, you know, I actually have that on tomorrow as a part of my positive things. They're called Partners Worldwide. Basically, I'll just show you a few pictures, their website and whatnot. But they basically, it's business people, successful business people, and they are in countries around the world. They come alongside of people. They do, and we'll talk about all this, microloans and so on. And it's wonderful. I was just so thrilled when I found that NGO. And they were mentioned on our video here. That's why I brought them up today. Here we are. Now, I'm going to just do a short video introducing this Hernando de Soto, okay? Let's see. Actually, I have 25 minutes is all I have. Wow. Let me, I kind of gave you a verbal introduction about him. And therefore, I think I'm going to go to this video. Okay, so this is going to be fairly long. You will see him in there, but I'm sorry I didn't have time to show you a little introduction of him and his work. Hernando de Soto. And he, again, he has had a huge influence around the world, basically working with private property and rule of law rights. He's going into as an advisor. He's invited into many, many countries. You know, again, I don't know what his belief system is. I'm kind of guessing he's Roman Catholic because he's from Peru. As far as I'm concerned, you know, he's a man of God, as it were. He stood up at the peril of his life, and he is giving his life in a wonderful and powerful way. And helping the poor, okay?
Human beings created in the image of God.
As Christians, we're called to help. But sometimes, our help can make things worse.
We wanted to learn more, so we hit the road.
Is that okay, or?
We go and look at the tallest tree in the forest and pick the best seed of that tallest tree and plant it in a flower pot.
You get about a meter high or less than a meter high plant.
And it's actually a flick out that tall tree that you saw in the forest. So what's wrong with this little one? Is it the seed? No, we pick the best seed possible, planted it on that. So what's wrong? The wrong thing is the flower pot, because you didn't allow the base on which it could grow. If you had planted it in the real soil, it would be as tall as the tree that you saw in the forest.
Except poor people
are bonsai people. Society doesn't provide them the base.
One of the trends in development is a growing appreciation for entrepreneurship and enterprise solutions to poverty. When you look around the developing world, one thing is clear. The problem isn't a lack of entrepreneurs. What's lacking is the fertile soil that allows entrepreneurs to flourish. We've talked about access to capital, but it's more than that. What poor countries need are the conditions of justice. Things like private property and rule of law that allow individuals and families to create wealth and prosperity for themselves and their communities.
Now, property rights and rule of law can seem mundane and academic, especially when people are in dire need. But as we'll see, the Bible repeatedly emphasizes their importance, in part because they are crucial to creating justice and opportunity for the poor.
Here we are in Kenya. And the one thing that is manifestly obvious on any street you walk down in Kenya is the energy of the people. You can just tell that they're looking for opportunities, they're going someplace, they have a sense of determination, they have a sense of purpose. And yet, just in back of the facility that we're at here, there's a huge slum the size of Central Park. Why is that?
My name is Joshua Omoga. I'm a businessman. I left my rural area, come to Nairobi to search for a job and better my life. After searching for a job for more than 5 years, I could not find a job. So I started a small scale business. I borrowed some money from a friend and started by selling vegetables. My doorsteps. And half of that small scale business is what is now sustaining me.
When I was in Nairobi, I had the chance to talk with Joshua and visit his shop in Kibera. He has no private property or land titling, so he can't get access to the sort of financial tools that business people in the West take for granted.
I live in the same place I work, and this place is very small. The place is not mine, so you cannot expand it. It's not easy to register the business because Kibera has temporary structures, and the government does not recognize temporary structures to be registered. So that's one of the challenges I'm facing. My future plan is to invest heavily in my business. And I'm planning to relocate from Kibera to another place where life's more better than Kibera and register my business. For now, I'm saving for my son so that when he reaches the time he's going to start his school, primary level, I'll be having something in the account to support his education.
Joshua is like many entrepreneurs, looking to provide a better future for their families. But this lack of clear private property rights and rule of law stifles the entrepreneurial spirit and blocks the capacity to create prosperity for themselves and their communities. One of the things that's very interesting when you come to Argentina and you arrive in Buenos Aires, it's one of the most beautiful cities in the world. You think you're in Paris or some lovely European capital. It has wide streets, beautiful architecture, an abundance of restaurants and cafes, and a rich cultural life. Yet only a mile from here, we can see some of the most intense poverty imaginable.
Sometimes the physical differences between rich and poor neighborhoods are so palpable that it's easy to miss an immaterial difference. The poor section has almost no access to the courts, no enforcement of contract, no clear property title, and often very little police protection. It lacks the rule of law. We saw this concretely in an area outside of Buenos Aires called Macaba. Marcos Hilding Olsen is a city councilman of the local area who works closely with leaders and residents in Macaba to help develop the rule of law.
Macaba is this shanty town where different estimates calculate between 15 or 20,000 people live there. Policemen don't go inside of it. There's no taxes. People don't even pay for their electricity. And so it's a place where they live apart from the rule of law. A few years ago, there was some really high crime rates in the area of Old San Isidro. And many people blamed it that many of the crimes came from people inside the Gama. So the government decided to put policemen, but they put policemen on the borders of the Gama. They go around the streets, but they don't go inside. Is a sort of wall that they put, but you actually, it's a way of protecting people that live outside the car from people that live inside it. But they won't protect the people that live inside it, they are the ones that actually suffer the most insecurity of all. Most of the people that live inside of it are people that are hardworking and they want to have a better life and they want to develop and they try to get their kids to school and they're really struggling to have a better life.
The real problem for large numbers of people is that hitherto, at any rate, there has been no reason to make an effort because any effort to improve their situation will just be expropriated by the political class.
When you have corruption in a country, people are just discouraged. There is no hope. They don't see themselves successful. In the long term, the government is not putting in place that environment that can help you to have that hope. It's just useless.
The rule of law, I think, is best understood by considering its opposite, which is the rule of man. The rule of man is when you have the rule of force, the rule of power, the rule of arbitrary subjective opinion. The rule of law means that there are stable, reasonable laws that apply to everyone, regardless of their station in life. In many developing countries, you really don't have rule of law. You don't have contracts. You have corrupt judges, you have people who have judges sitting in on their own court cases who happen to be their brother or their sister.
Football match without rules. But you don't get a game going. The rules are crucial to get that game going. But everybody knows how to drive a ball. Everybody knows how to buy and sell. So there's plenty of entrepreneurship in the world. The problem are the rules. In two-thirds of the world, there isn't yet the rule of law.
Fernando de Soto is one of the world's leading experts in economic development. In his work, De Soto emphasized the need to extend the rule of law to the poor, who are often left out of the system by a wall of complex regulations that only the rich and well-connected can possibly navigate.
A lawyer friend of ours in Lima told us, law is not a problem. Hernando, we set up a small company for you in about 30 days. So we set up a small little workshop outside Lima with two sewing machines and put four students under the supervision of a mature lawyer to go out and take a bus every morning at 8 o'clock and go out and comply with all the legal requirements to have those two sewing machines operate at the shirt-making factory. and it took them working 8 hours a day, 289 days. That's when we became acquainted with the fact that depending on what side of the social scale you were in, the law was either a friend or was the big enemy, and you had to change it.
So we talked about it taking 289 days to register a business in Peru. I can guarantee you that if, you know, businessman X from family, you know, A, tries to start a business, he could do it within 5. And we've actually have research that shows that, that within each country, there's a big range in which things can happen extremely fast and efficiently in developing countries. If you know the minister, if you have connections. And if you don't, you're on the other end. So it's not that people don't have the capacity to be much more efficient. It's that the access is not democratized.
The legal systems are simply unfriendly to poor people.
Poor people are really hostile to is markets that are manipulated, markets that are not competitive. Markets in which there isn't a level playing field. There's oligopolies, cartels.
When you go from these heavy, oppressive, authoritarian regimes, communist regimes, and you replace them with oligarchies, you haven't really done anything substantial economically. You can have all kinds of people trading things that you could, in a sense, call mini-capitalists. But when those markets are restricted, this is not a free economy.
Just as there are people who use communism just simply to stay in power and to be able to have a discourse, some kind of a speech that allows them to justify the reason of their permanence in power, well, some businessmen use all the intellectual structures of capitalism to preserve their own privileges, but in fact they're futile because it's very hard to get inside the game without their permission. They use the terms but not the content.
One place where the rule of law problem is vividly apparent is in the area of property rights. Imagine if there were no private property. If you didn't even know who owned the land you lived on. It wouldn't only change the way you work, it would change the way you view the world. Now in the West, we take private property for granted. But lack of clear private property rights is one of the greatest challenges facing the developing world. In some countries, over 70% of the land has no clear title. You can't get out of poverty without private property.
The rule of law is more than property. But what I'm saying is that what makes people interested in the rule of law, the first thing that they understand is that everybody on this earth lives on a plot of land. We're earthlings. And so if you come around and say, look, we have found rules that determine how far you can go and how far somebody else can go, how you're going to share or not share water, are you going to have passing rights or not having passing rights? That's the first thing that anybody needs to understand the rule of law. It's quite clear that when you go to the third world and people are warring against each other, there's high crimes, there are ethnic rivalries. Once you settle the issue of who lives where and who does what with who, people start understanding the value of standard rules. That you not only have to have rules that you and your group respect, but that everybody understands. That moment, the simplest person can understand the law.
Property rights are a terrible problem. Terrible, terrible problem. Like 60-70% of our people are farmers. Just imagine if you have 10 million farmers who have no title to the land they're farming on. We haven't got the title in Ghana. It's very, very difficult. You buy land, you have to buy it 4 or 5 times. If you're looking for farmland, as a small peasant farmer, looking for 5 acres to buy. You can get 5 acres from the chief by giving him a drip. But you don't own the 5 acres. So you can't go to the bank with the 5 acres as your collateral.
to then borrow money to buy a tractor. You can't start an economy without ownership not being in question. This is my fundamental.
A property right as opposed to sovereignty means it doesn't have a flag. It belongs to smaller groups of people, and it's fungible. It can be sold and can be bought. So, say you're not given a property right. Let's look at all the indigenous people of the Americas who never got a property right, so that they couldn't lose it, they couldn't drink it away, they couldn't do a bad investment. Did they keep it? No, they've lost it much more than those who are getting property rights today. So, in each case, what we should do is go to indigenous people and say, what do you want? Sovereignty, so that the Indian chief decides what's going to happen, or a property right? I can tell you the answer right away. But they're not generally given those options.
None of the great sad stories is something that looked like the start of a real honest industrial revolution started in China about the 10th century. They had some small iron smelters, and people owned and kept reinvesting and increased production, and they got bigger and bigger. And they suddenly started making all kinds of agricultural utensils out of iron steel. And these blast furnaces going day and night. And of course, it's all coming on boats down the Yangtze and the Yellow, and all that's good stuff. And eventually, the Mandarins discovered this was going on, and that ordinary people were getting rich. They stopped it. They closed it down. The whole thing stopped and went away. Look, a great historian of Asia put it well. He said, private property is not secure. And that's the first and last and total answer to why there was no development in the East. If they can come and take my steel mill away from me and close it down, well, my relatives have learned let's not, no point starting again. Let's get a government job.
Property rights play an essential role in economic development, but there's evidence that their effect runs much deeper. Here in Argentina, there's an interesting study to see what happens when people who did not have private property get private property. Well, it not only changes their economic relationship with others, it actually changes their worldview.
We found that the people in the title parcels, they trust each other more. We found that children in the title houses are more likely to go into secondary school. They have a lower school absenteeism. They have better health. They show lower teenage pregnancies. Land title integrated them to the average population, and now they seem to share the belief and the values of the more average population, although they are still quite poor.
The roots of widespread private property can be found in the Judeo-Christian.
Okay, so we're starting to talk about solutions. Hernando de Soto is huge in that. Tomorrow we'll be talking about another individual who's had a huge impact and something that is a little closer to something that we might, I'm not saying would be, but we might be able to get involved in. And yes.
Can you identify when helping someone becomes enabling them to do nothing?
Well, you're talking about on an individual, local basis. Yeah, you know, my plan is to talk about that, like on the fifth day here. But clearly, if an individual, you know, I read about one guy shared his story on a mission trip where he was painting a house, and the strong, healthy teenage boys who lived in that house were sitting on the front porch. That'd be a pretty clear example. But it kind of starts before that. It kind of starts before that in the sense of partnering. If we ourselves have sort of said what the activity is going to be to help these people, and there's less chance that they're going to buy into it and be involved in it. If we have kind of partnered with them, let them try to help them use their power to think and to do, to come up with the plan themselves and to envision the benefits for them, there's a much better chance that they will, you know, buy into it and take part in it. I've read of, mission trips or churches who have gone to places and installed, you know, an electric generator. And 6-7 months later, they got a letter saying, your generator is broke down. Could you come and fix it? So there's a lot to partnering so that people take ownership. But I would say in the short answer to your question, if a person is not doing things, one person said, and I don't know if I buy this totally, but I certainly had I've tried to make it have an influence on me. One person said paternalism, and he said, don't do anything for anybody that they can do for themselves. That's pretty strong. But it's certainly something to keep in mind, to think about. And I just said that to a person not too long ago who called me up and asked me about taking her to down to social services. And this person's been in this country for quite a while. And I don't know how it sounded, because I said, I think you can do that yourself. And I think it might have been a little bit of a shock, because maybe they weren't used to that with me, so anyway.
In other words, it's an individual basis.
Yeah, I can't give you a rule for every... Okay.
I watch this, and I love ADRA, so I want to know, do you feel that ADRA is on point with this? They do have programs where they're in Cal Bank and doing these different things. Do we feel that ADRA is our own organization? Are we doing what, or do we need to have more there?
I really don't know. I wanted to learn. I do know that I really enjoy the videos that ADRA has on their website, different individuals' lives who have been changed and so on. I enjoy that.
ADRA usually helps the community, like Africa, they drill 2 minutes of no water.
Right, they drill well.
Everybody benefits, okay?
Yeah.
There's no political things involved.
Yeah.
Pure community service. And that's the kind of work they do. They went to Burma, they're doing the same thing.
Yes, praise God. All right, let me just say a short prayer. I have to let you go, okay? Father in heaven, just thank you for light and understanding regarding our poverty-stricken brothers and sisters in this world. Just lead us and guide us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.